Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. I want to welcome today's guests, which are joining me as a panel to share with you best practices with open enrollment, what works and what doesn't. Our panel includes Marilyn Monahan of Monahan Law Office, one of our favorite regular guests, my business partner, Anthony McCarron, Vice President of Client Services, and Ann Kelly, one of our broker co-op partners from Kelly & Kelly Insurance Services. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks, Dorothy. I'm very happy to be here with you today and Anthony and Anne to share tips on conducting a successful open enrollment.
Hello, everyone. This is Anne Kelly, founder of Kelly & Kelly Insurance Services and Patrick & Patrick Insurance Services. We have two agencies in the co-op, and I'm hoping that today we can give you some invaluable pointers on your open enrollment process and preparing for that.
This is Anthony McCarron. This is my first podcast ever, and I'm happy to be here.
And I'm still shocked that we were able to get you to participate in this, Anthony, because as everyone else that knows you knows, you're the very quiet type and you always let me take the public stage. So anyway, this is a topic that's right in your wheelhouse, so you really didn't have a choice. I guess you were voluntold for this. So I want to welcome Anthony for being on the podcast because, again, this is not his forte at all. I asked you all here to share with our listeners your experiences over the years working on open enrollments and sharing some helpful information on best practices and what we found works well, and perhaps share some of the things that won't work as well. So let's get into it. Marilyn, I'm going to start with you. Before open enrollment actually begins, there's a lot of legal and regulatory work that needs to be done. I guess we can call it a checklist of all the compliance to-dos. First off, I think most of our listeners are aware of this, but for those who may not be, what employers have to offer health coverage?
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as the ACA, employers with 50 or more employees may be penalized by the IRS if they do not offer coverage to their full-time employees, and one of those employees obtains coverage through an exchange such as Covered California and qualifies for a premium tax credit from the government to help pay for that coverage. So employers with 50 or more employees, referred to as applicable large employers or ALEs under the ACA, are the ones who should be offering coverage to their employees to ensure they do not face penalties. Smaller employers are not required to offer coverage, but there are many good reasons for doing so.
Marilyn, assuming that you have to have coverage, or if you just want to offer it, even if it's not required, you know, what are the open enrollment disclosure requirements for employers in general? For example, what do they need to have in their open enrollment packets each year? And what about all the other disclosure requirements?
Well, in summary, you need to distribute the Summary Plan Description, or SPD. That's the most important document to make sure you get out to the employees. You also should accompany that by the WRAP document if you have one, the SBCs for the major medical coverage, and along with any other annual or mandatory notices required by various federal laws. These documents should also include eligibility terms and a contribution schedule.
Marilyn, when does an employer have to provide foreign language translations? Obviously, we have a large number of Spanish-speaking people here in California and other areas, plus we have a lot of Asians and so forth. When do employers have to provide foreign language translations?
Well, the good news is that you are not required to translate the SPD, which is usually a very long document. However, in some cases, you may have to provide a notice in a language other than English, explaining to participants that they can obtain assistance in the non-English language, and then you have to provide that assistance in the non-English language. Whether you have to provide this translated notice depends on how many employees you have working for you who are literate in a language other than English. So these are the rules. First, if you have a plan that covers fewer than 100 participants at the beginning of the plan year, and 25% or more are literate only in the same non-English language, you have to provide that translated notice. Or if your plan covers 100 or more participants at the beginning of the plan year, you have to provide that translated notice if the lesser of under 500 or 10% or more are literate only in the same non-English language. By the way, the Department of Labor has model language you can use for this purpose. Now, let me point out that these are the legal requirements. This is the minimum standard, but there is a good reason for them. You want your employees to understand the benefits you are offering to them so they can make an informed decision as to what coverage is best for them and their families. Now, I mentioned earlier the SBC, the Summary of Benefits and Coverage, which major medical carriers or your major medical plan has to provide. The rules as to translations are a little bit different for the SBC. Whether or not you have to translate those is based on the population of your county. In some cases, SBCs have to be translated into Spanish, Chinese, Tagalog, or Navajo. You are not obligated to translate the SBC into other languages if your employees speak a language other than one of those four. But then again, it may be to the benefit of your employees to do so. So again, that they understand the benefits that are being offered to them.
Well, thanks for that, Marilyn. I appreciate it. Let's move on. Assuming that we have some of these compliance matters handled, let's get more into the actual open enrollment acts. And let's start with you. You deal with fully insured arrangements, and a lot of your clients offer online enrollments and benefits administration with either their payroll company, with Ease, Employee Navigator, or similar. I know that you work a lot with Ease yourself. For an employer thinking about starting this sort of benefits administration system, what are the main considerations in deciding whether to use a system for benefits administration? And when is it good and when is it not as good or not as important?
For employers that are considering for the first time using one of these systems, I suggest that you move fast and you start looking at these now. That being said, there's a huge learning curve with all of these systems. And what we found is that most agencies, even that are using the system, their account managers are watching video after video for several months, trying to build their groups into the system, and they still don't have it operational. Our agency, because I was education chair for the health underwriters, I have a passion for helping other agencies and helping others learn. So we actually go out and help other agencies get up and running with these systems. And it takes us 2 full days working with another agency to have them be able to then completely build their client base into the system and launch that then for open enrollment. So I hope those of you that are listening and paying attention to what I'm saying, you're hearing that this, even for an agency, takes a lot of training to become competent in these systems. So when you are looking to put in this system, I would suggest that you use an agency that already has a proven track record or has been using one of these systems for several years. Some agencies will tend to go to a general agent or go to Employee Navigator or Ease and have them build the group into the system. That can take several weeks, and there are always traffic jams at year end when most groups are renewing. So if your agency that you are using is going to use the computer software people to do that for them themselves, go in several months ahead of time so that you're making sure your system will be up and running on time. We here at our agency, we build our own system for our own clients, and we're actually probably more competent and it's done more customized than you would get going directly to one of the providers.
And when is it not as important to an employer to have a benefits administration system?
We have heard that some employers that have employees that are not computer friendly or not computer literate, they prefer the old fashioned way of getting manual handouts and doing group meetings and collecting the application forms and then processing them themselves through the carriers. But it's long, and I really sincerely believe that in the next several years, the majority of businesses will be using these systems, probably actually in the next 5 years. And we're also hearing that AI may take over, which I sincerely doubt. Looking at how difficult it is already, I don't think AI will do a good job on employee benefits.
I hope not, because yeah. that's something that's, you know, really needs to have that personal touch. And I don't think machines can really do that as much.
Absolutely not, Arithi. And they'll make mistakes and there'll be things not done properly. So it's, I'm adamant that AI won't take over. I really sincerely believe that would be a massive fail.
So what do you do about groups that are maybe highly Hispanic only speaking? Maybe their jobs are outside, like landscapers and so forth. We have some of those types of clients. Yeah, as you mentioned, they may not have computers. These types of clients don't. Many may not have any idea on how to do something like enroll in a system like Ease. So what is best for that type of group? And I think that Anthony can speak to that, because that affects a lot of our clients. Anthony?
Well, we have a large landscape company of about 1,500 employees, and there is no way they can do Ease or online enrolling. They have to do paper enrollment. So what we do is, for all the new hires and for open enrollment, we go out, and almost every form in there is English and Spanish. Obviously, the SBT is not in Spanish, but the enrollment form on the front is English, on the back is Spanish. It's funny, because when we got this group 20 years ago, they said, oh, all of our employees speak and read English and understand it. Well, when we went out for the first time doing open enrollment meetings, we found this not to be true. So one of the things we do is, of course, we have English meetings, and then we have Spanish meetings. So we have both, and then we have a few extra Spanish speakers that for questions afterwards, because some of these meetings are 200-300 people we're talking to. So to get them, you know, if they have individual questions afterwards, they can come over and talk to us. And then basically the Spanish, our Spanish person may not know the answers. So then they ask me and I give them the answer and they relay the information to the employee. But definitely for large groups, especially highly Hispanic groups, I would say always do paper applications for them. Just the easiest way possible, because you'll have a lot of problems if you try to do anything else.
Yeah, the educational needs, as far as a lot of these software companies don't have Spanish applications within them, so that makes it a little bit more difficult. Anthony, we work with a lot of large and self-funded employers. Some were using systems like Ease, and later they moved to their payroll companies instead. Why is that, particularly for these larger employers? Was there a duplication of efforts in some cases?
Oh, definitely. In fact, of my large groups, none of them use Ease. Some of my smaller groups do use Ease, but they all use their payroll company, because it specifically helps for their end of the year reporting, their 1094s, 95s at the end of the year. So it goes through a lot easier than that. Plus, let's use ADP as an example. When they put in the information every few days or weekly or nightly, I'm not sure how often, but it's downloaded to the TPA and then put in there immediately. So it's within a day or two and they're up and running, and an ID card generated through the TPA. It works easier. And then they're only putting it in one spot, because if they use Ease with self-funded plans, it doesn't go to the TPA for, you know, to add them to the plan.
Right. So, Anne, obviously there are some differences in using a system like an Ease system, depending on whether they're fully insured or self-funded, as Anthony mentioned, because they may not have all the uplinks and so forth. But coming back to the Ease type system, if it's fully insured, how does that work with the ACA reporting?
We found, particularly when we're looking at, you know, prospective clients, that there are time and time again, huge issues with the Ease system. And it's not that there's a problem with the Ease ACA module. It's because it's not being used correctly. There are agencies that are handing clients these employee navigator systems, these Ease systems, and doing group meetings and then walking away. And if this client has large turnover and they are not making sure to get the employees to log into the system and waive benefits and e-sign, then the system isn't capturing the waivers. And what I've noticed when we've gone out to prospective clients and looked at their reports from these systems, this 1095C that the employee gets, and that in California, we send a copy into the IRS and the Franchise Tax Board, under Section 16 of that form is when you respond to the IRS or the corresponding authority telling them what happened to the offer, whether it was declined, and they're to use W-2 box 1 to measure the afford that the Section 15 lowest cost plan employee paid share of cost was affordable or not, is left blank. When the employee doesn't log into the system, there is nothing put in Section 16. So what that's telling the IRS is basically they didn't get an affordable offer. They never received the offer. So if those employees go out and take subsidies on the marketplace, that's going to trigger an audit. And the employer has to be able to come up with a signed waiver form that they don't have on file. And trust me, I have seen employer groups where over 50% of employees have not logged into that system and signed a waiver. So that's hugely problematic. Another thing we've seen, both on the EASE systems, the Employee Navigator systems, as well as the payroll systems that employers are using to do these 1094, 1095 reports, is that if you don't program these systems correctly, they're going to spit out garbage. And a lot of times, either the payroll company or the agents are just push button a report into the IRS and the Franchise Tax Board, and nobody is actually reviewing those reports for correctness.
Garbage
and
in,
that's going to cause audits.
Yeah.
Garbage in, garbage out. And time and time again, this week alone, I saw a prospective client that was using, I won't name the payroll provider, but when I said, can I just review very quickly, put my eyes on your last year's 1095s. 2 minutes into it, I'm saying to her, you're paying 75% of the employee only cost on a silver plan, which is a lot. And yet I'm seeing employees paying $500-$700 a month. There's something wrong. She had put not the lowest cost plan into the payroll system, but this silver plan, and she had programmed it with the full premium rate, not the employee share of premium. We went back several years. This was wrong for several years. Either the payroll company hadn't set eyes on it, and she hadn't asked anybody, including her agent, to look at these reports.
Yeah.
Marilyn will attest to it. If you have to issue corrected 1095 forms, it's a couple of $100. It's almost $300 per form. And now you're correcting them with the IRS, the state of California, as well as the employees. So you could be up to $900 per form corrected. And there were a lot of them. So I can't emphasize, whether you're agents or whether you're employers, garbage in, garbage out. You need somebody reviewing these reports that understands and has a thorough knowledge of how they're supposed to be reported. Either your agent has that knowledge, or you use somebody like a Marilyn Monaghan or a Dorothy Koshu or myself to take a look over those and make sure they're done correctly.
Thank you for that. Marilyn, did you want to make any comments on that, respond to what Ann just said?
I did want to chime in there to emphasize two points. Well, to emphasize one point and to bring up one new point related to the 1094, 1095 forms. What I wanted to emphasize was, yes, you absolutely have to review those forms before they're actually filed. For various reasons, mistakes can creep into the process, and you need to be certain that you are comfortable with the data that is being reported to the government. But the new point that I wanted to raise is, starting in 2024, all employers are going to have to electronically file their 1094s and their 1095s. So that's another thing to be talking to your providers about. Can they help facilitate that electronic filing process, or are you going to have to set that up yourself? So I just wanted to add that reminder in there as well.
And that's something that they should consider now before open enrollment, because, again, that's going to affect how all this stuff is input and how the reporting is done later on. So that's why I wanted to talk about it today. So thank you very much for that. And I want to come back to you once again. Have any of your clients in the fully insured world had issues with duplicate work? For example, if their carrier doesn't have an automatic upload into a system like EASE, just as an example, Anthem, how can that be handled best? What does the employer have to do? I mean, because is it kind of duplicate work there to upload it twice? How does that work?
Yes, it is duplicate work. There's agencies there like ourselves where we have online access with all carriers and we have full-time processors that do nothing but process the apps that the e-system doesn't automatically EDT feed into the carrier systems. So, and that takes a lot of resources. You're going back to the old-fashioned method. Either you're faxing in an app or you're processing it online. We prefer to process ourselves from our own office so that we know it's done right. We can catch an error in the carrier system immediately and we're not waiting in line year end because the carriers have too many groups that are renewing and it's taking them several weeks to process apps. All of our employers have online access to the carrier system so that they can also duplicate that work if they prefer, or they can simply use that to pull invoices and pay their systems online or to check to see if somebody is active or terminated in the system. We, in our e-system, under the employee's profile, as we process something, we put a note and a confirmation in under the employee's profile notes, letting the employer know that that was done. So, yes, you're right, Dorothy. It can create a lot of duplicate work and, you know, there's a lot of resources used. In fact, I think with ACA reporting and all the processing, it has, I think, in an average year, given us a 50% increase in labor resources to actually administer all of these. We're working harder than ever.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of our companies that are self-funded, and of course, something like an e-system doesn't always accommodate all of their specific needs. That's why a lot of our companies have, a lot of our clients have gone back to their payroll companies because we can actually adjust it, and they're only uploading once and not twice, and they have direct links to the third-party administrators for self-funded administration and so forth. So it does make a difference, and it's important that people understand this when they're, you know, looking towards what are we going to do for open enrollment. I'd like to address something that's going to affect a lot of employers next year in 2024. Since we've been talking about these systems, the sale of Ease to Employee Navigator has happened. It happened, I believe, in April of this past year, and they're going to be going into a major conversion. And I understand that that system conversion is not going to happen until 2024 now, but how is that going to affect this year's enrollment? Is it going to be okay for this year going into 2024's renewal year?
Yeah, we're speaking to the people at Employee Navigator because Kieran O'Neill Patrick in the Patrick and Patrick Insurance side is the professional development chair, which is basically education for the Orange County Health underwriters. So this is as much of a concern for GAs as it is for agencies like ourselves and employer groups. We started in the business using Employee Navigator and really did not like their service. It was create an e-ticket and then wait several days to get an answer. The answer did not apply to the problem and then you're back into a second e-ticket. We actually got refunded several months leasing that we paid to them over this problem. That problem hasn't been resolved. They still operate the same way. One of the things Employee Navigator did when they purchased Ease was to get rid of a lot of their service people. So that support line that was wonderful with the Ease system isn't really there anymore. I'm hoping George, who owns Employee Navigator, hears this because a lot of us are very concerned about it. Let me just say the good news. Hopefully they're listening because we are talking to them. Is many of the GAs, particularly the California GAs, they all got behind the e-system and they're all using the same system. So a lot of people in California, be it GA or agencies, they're using the e-system. And the GAs themselves, their software people have developed that system with ease. And they have people that are trained in the building the employer groups into that system. So far, the GAs I've been talking to, we're all waiting to see how Employee Navigator is going to handle this transition of Ease systems into theirs for, it's actually 2025 now. So we're holding our breath. We are telling Employee Navigator that they should launch two forks in our industry to help with this transition, and that is work through the GAs because they can educate the insurance agents on it, and work through the National Association of Health Underwriters and have them also put on seminars and workshops to help agencies move their clients into this transition.
Thank you.
That's all I can say for now. I'm as worried as you are about it.
Yeah.
It really depends on how they logistically handle this.
Well, thank you for that, Anne. And just for definitional purposes, so that people that may not know the terminology that Anne's mentioned, the GAs are general agencies, and those are the agencies where agents, for example, can go to get a lot of quotes from a lot of different carriers simultaneously, and they manage all of that. So that's what a GA is. And you mentioned the National Association of Health Underwriters, just so that you know, their name was changed last year to the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals, because it's obviously better defines what they do and what members like you and I, what we really do for our clients and so forth. So I just want to make those clarifications. So Anne, you talked about the fact that they're going to be moving into Employee Navigator from Ease, and I'm a little concerned about that. I want to talk to Anthony, because Anthony and I both come from the third-party administration background, so we have that claim system background behind us. And Anthony, you have a systems conversions background dealing with self-funded accounts who are working in the claims administration business. You know, you did that for me back in the day. What's your experience been like with these system conversions? Do they usually go as planned and on time and as scheduled?
Rarely. We've had many of them with our different TPAs over the years, and it is a mess usually. They usually say it's going to be, let's say, in January, but they don't start it until, let's say, July or August, if then. And then once they do, they say, oh, we're going to start it on Friday night, and it'll be up and running on Monday morning. That's almost never the case. One good thing about system conversions and the large group self-funding area is that they don't convert every group at the same time. So what Dorothy and I have done each time there is a conversion is say, we want to be the last people on your conversion list. In other words, if you're doing 20 groups in January, 20 in February, 20 in March, and that's it, we want to be the 20 in March, because then all their mistakes they have made before, we can cut off some of that time that it's not up and running. I mean, and then once it is up and running, something I just went through with one of our TPAs is after they did the conversion, they weren't able to create a billing from it, for a monthly billing from it. And so they had to go back and use the old system. So then they were using the old system and the new system, which created a lot more for them, created a lot more work and all that. But it's now finally good. After about 3 or 4 months, they were able to figure out there's always something wrong. And one little button isn't pushed on the conversion. And then they were unable in this case to create billings for them. Now, my groups only had 1 month of that. We were the third group of ones that were being converted at the time. So it just never goes to plan. So it's a nightmare for everybody.
Yeah. So I'm a little concerned about that, as I know Anne is, and Marilyn, you're going to get your share of these calls as well. So what would you advise clients that are currently using Ease and they're going to be moving into Employee Navigator? Anne, why don't you start with this? What are you advising clients now?
That's a hard one, Dorothy, because I'm worried. You know, personally, I don't have a lot of confidence in Employee Navigator. I told you that I don't like their support. And I feel like that's not going to change. I don't know if George, their owner, has learned that lesson or not, that it really is invaluable in our industry. Hopefully, they will use the GAs more as a tool to educate and train. If that's the case, I have full confidence in our general agencies and in our professional development organizations within our industry to actually really seriously do a great job of helping with that transition. So it depends on which way they go. I'm holding my breath and I am very nervous about it myself.
Okay,
and I think as anybody should be.
I'm going to make a suggestion here, and some of this is going to come from a prior conversation that you and I have had, because you're the expert in Ease more so than I am, of course. But I have the systems and conversion background, as Anthony has, because we worked in the TPA business for so many years. I'm going to suggest that they do some of the things that you and I talked about last week. For example, go ahead and pull down your reports for the last several years. You know, you have to look back 7 years in California, 6 years federal, but 7 years for records retention, right? So before this transition happens, my recommendation would be to get all that data gathered so that you have a file, an electronic file for 7 years history. Pull down all your census detail, pull down all your ACA reports, pull down all the enrollment stuff, the month-by-month reports. Get all that stuff in advance of the conversion so that if they do go down and it doesn't convert properly, that you have a backup and that you can actually work from that data and go forward from there. So that's one of the recommendations that I would make. And again, that came a lot from our discussion last week. And so I would think that employers might be thinking about, and maybe people like you and I can advise them, let's have a backup of our own just in case the system goes
down.
And
we can get into the weeds on that because I've spoken to Employee Navigator. I told them that one of our clients was in a lawsuit this year where an employee said they were never offered benefits. And because the EASE system tracks every email that was sent to that employee, every time that employee logged into the system, because we kept in the profile notes every time we contacted that employee via phone or in person to try and get their benefits done, we were able to send all of that correspondence and proof to the lawyer, and we never heard a peep out of them again. I'm concerned that we could end up in a similar lawsuit with this transition or after the transition to Navigator and not be able to pull those records. That's going to be a problem. As you said, Dorothy, all of these systems, currently, if an agent takes over a group that already has EASE, they do not duplicate the company's records over to the new agent. Instead, they ask the old one to transfer the records. That is a legal issue. And those of us who know the law, we will refuse to do that because we are required by law to keep records for several years. And I've explained that to these computer software companies, again, because they don't know insurance law as much as we would, that that's problematic. So again, whether or not they address this issue, it's going to be a problem. And even if we download all the records, just how much of that can you download? You know, it's going to be a problem. So we're talking to them and we're hoping that they're listening to some of the advice that we are giving them on this transition.
Let me ask Anthony, do you have any additional comments on that?
Actually, I agree with everything Ann said, and I only have a couple of EASE groups, so it's really not going to affect me.
Yeah, Marilyn, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
I'll just add in general, it's never a bad idea to have a duplicate copy of your records because lots of things can happen in life with regard to companies change ownership, they systems go down, systems fail. It's never a bad idea to have a duplicate copy so that if you're ever audited later on, there's a sale of the business, there's a lawsuit situation like Ann talked about, you can easily and quickly access the data you need.
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, let's move on a little bit. Let's talk about educating people, you know, on their benefits during open enrollment. What works best for you, Anne? How do you educate everyone?
Well, this is where these systems absolutely excel. And as an educator, I think it's wonderful the capabilities and the amount of education you can use the EASE system for example. Marilyn began this podcast today talking about the required documents that you have to give out to the employees at open enrollment. You know, your RAP doc, your summary plan doc, the Affordable Care Act requires you to give your new hires as well as your existing employees the SBCs. That's a summary benefit and coverage description. It's an 8-page document per plan. And there's other required notices, your HIPAA notice, initial COBRA notice, your handbooks, all of these can actually be put in the document section and the notification section in your EASE system, and they are available to employees all year round. What we like to do is under the notification section, we will build in even extra information so that employees can look at things like how do you qualify for Medi-Cal or Medicaid or the marketplace subsidies. And we have charts that show the federal poverty level per family size and how the adults and children can qualify for those programs. And you can open that up for an employer, or show them where it is to access that information. We don't use the Department of Labour mandatory marketplace notice. We have our own notice, and that notice covers the penalties. The fact that the employer either offers or may not offer a program that meets the affordability measure. We show the employee the affordability measures and how they work. In other words, the formula the IRS will use if they're ever auditing Section 15 with the affordable offer on your 1095. So there's an hourly formula and a W-2 box 1 for salaried people formula that they use. And then it talks about if you are taking subsidies through the marketplace, you have to file a report with the IRS with your tax return every year, justifying the monies that you got based on your income and the offer of an affordable coverage through your employer. We have a section on Medicare. More and more people are staying in the workforce and aging up onto Medicare. And it's a big decision now whether or not they stay on the employer's group insurance or whether they go on Medicare with maybe a supplemental plan. And some of the decision process with that would be size of the employer, who pays primary, who pays secondary. If they go on Medicare or if they stay on their employer plan, they need to then verify if they're staying on an employer's coverage, if the employer's plan that they're on is a credible coverage. In other words, Medicare will acknowledge that plan or not. Some bronze plans and some plans are not credible, and it'll cause you penalties with Medicare. IRMA, how to calculate what you're going to pay for Medicare Part B, and that goes up as income goes up. And then we have sections on state disability and how to claim for that, how to log in and file an online claim. Those stay in that system year round, and employees have access to that. On a normal open enrollment, you've no way of conveying that level of knowledge to an employee. This is where these systems absolutely excel.
Thank you very much. Anthony, what about you? I should say us, because it's our my company as well. You know, how do we do employee benefits education during open enrollment?
What we do for some of our larger groups, actually all of them, is we do employee benefits fairs, usually a month out of the renewal date. And what we do there is we bring food, drinks, things like that to entice people to come in. We also invite all of the vendors, and specifically in self-funding, like we'll invite the TPA, the third-party administrator, whoever that is. We'll invite, if they're with a PPO network, let's say Anthem, we'll invite them if they have a voluntary life coverage, you know, so there'll be the EAP program will be there, and many different vendors. Let's say they're offering Aflac or Colonial or something like that. They would be there also. So we set that up. We do that for about 4 or 5 hours during one day, and we'll do each location because a lot of the larger groups that we have multiple locations. So we try to get it all done in 1 week. That way we don't spread it out over 2 or 3 weeks for 5 different locations. But so we do that. What we also do is during on the top of every hour, we go out and we have everybody sit down and we go over the open enrollment meeting. We create a PowerPoint. We go up in front of the room. We speak. We tell them any changes, any benefit changes. And we just go over everything. You know, if you don't want to, if you don't want any changes, you just fill out this form and do that. And so everything's, for the most part, everything's paper. And we give them open enrollment packets, which have everything, the copy of the PowerPoint presentation, and every form that's required that Marilyn spoke about earlier. But we also put all their different benefits. So if they have a group life plan, we put in, you know, not just saying you have a group life plan of $20,000 flat. We say, you know, we also give them the reduction schedule once they hit age 65 or 70. And all this stuff, we have videos for all of our clients that, and even our smaller clients that, let's say, that discuss the No Surprises Act, the recent No Surprises Act. And it's a 10-minute video. Everybody has it. Usually they put it online on their company website or their payroll, if employees have access to their payroll.
And they can put it on their platform, whatever platforms they have. Yeah,
whatever platform they want, they would put it up there too. That way it's always available to them. But we, you know, and we also how to find a provider. I mean, we do things as just simple as how to find a provider, how to read your EOB or explanation of benefits when you get it from the TPA after a bill is paid. I mean, we do a lot of them. Some of them are real basic and simple, but some of them actually go into some pretty good detail on certain subjects.
Well, Anthony, I do want to make one additional comment and clarification based on something that you said a few moments ago. You said that everything was done on paper, and that is the case for some of our clients that have highly Hispanic populations and so forth, and for those that wanted paper copies handed out at open enrollment. But just as an FYI, we also have the option to, and some of our clients only want a few sheets of very important paper, like forms that they have to complete in those paper copies, and then the rest of it we will put electronically on their portals, whatever those portals may be, whether it's through their payroll company or through an ease-type platform or whatever it is. Sometimes we just give them a page on our own website to house all of this information. So whatever works for the client. So sometimes it's all paper. Sometimes it's a combination of paper and electronic, and sometimes it's all electronic, basically, depending on what the client needs are. And then we also record videos for each of our clients as well. We record all of our open enrollment presentations, including all the educational materials, and we have that available. We can have it on their portals and so forth, and people that weren't there during open enrollment, people are absent on vacation, whatever. And then we subsidize that with a new hire video. We basically use the same information and just replace out from open enrollment to the new hire so that they always have that available. It really helps out the education from the human resources perspective, because they can literally just have all their employees while they're sitting filling out paperwork. They can also be watching the videos of how everything works, not only at open enrollment, but also throughout the year. So thank you for that.
Dorothy and Anthony, can I chime in here with a comment about open enrollment? One of the recommendations I would make is putting together methodology so you can track who attended the open enrollment meetings and who didn't. And I was reminded, Dorothy, when you mentioned people who are out on leave or COBRA qualified beneficiaries or employees who are just busy that day and weren't able to show up. You want to make certain that they're given an opportunity to go through the open enrollment process so you can establish that they were in fact given an offer of coverage and given a chance to elect which benefits they want. You can do that through sign-in sheets. You can do that through, checking the ease system to see who signed in and who didn't. But I think that's an important part of the process.
Yes, very good. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Marilyn, how important is it to educate plan participants on all these new laws and regulations? You know, Anthony, for example, used the No Surprises Act as one of the types of things that we educate people on. Give us some examples on recent important laws that employers should be educating their plan participants on.
Well, it is very important to keep people apprised of some of these new changes to the extent they affect their benefits. Now, obviously, there's a whole slew of new laws and regulations, it seems like, almost every year. Some of them are done in the background from the participants' perspective. The employers know about them, but there's no real reason for the participants to know about them, like the RxDC reporting and the gag clause attestations. But other provisions do affect benefits. Usually they enhance the benefits. Sometimes it might be the reverse. But when they enhance the benefits, you want employees to know that that new level of benefits is out there for them. The No Surprises Act is an excellent example of how it's going to change the way people might make decisions about which ER to go to, whether to sign that consent form that they've been presented by that out-of-network provider, and what options that they have. So that's a great example. Another thing that changes often every year are the preventive care benefits. They usually supplement that every year or every other year with new preventive care benefits that if you have a non-grandfathered plan are covered without cost sharing. Another example I'll give you is the online price comparison tool, which was created by the CAA. That doesn't enhance a particular benefit, but what it does do is it allows participants to go on to the insurance company or the self-funded plan's website, to the TPA's website, and they can search in advance. If they know they're going to have, for example, an MRI, they can run a search and they can find out what the plan estimates it will cost them if they go in network versus out of network. So those are things that help participants and their family members make better decisions, make them usually more satisfied with their plan because they understand they've got now a new level of benefits that's being offered to them. So I think it is definitely something that you should be talking about during the open enrollment process.
Well, thank you. Well, let's talk about establishing employee contributions each year for open enrollment. I'd like to hear all your thoughts on this. Marilyn, let's start with you. What's important for ACA applicable large employers?
Well, applicable large employers should make certain that the amount the employee is being asked to contribute toward self-only coverage for the employer's lowest cost plan satisfies the ACA's affordability standards. If they do, the employer reduces or even eliminates the risk of a penalty under the shared responsibility rules contained in the ACA. And those penalties can be expensive, so employers want to set up their benefits and their contribution structure to avoid them.
And Anne, what are the most important considerations for your agency and your employer clients on, you know, contribution calculations? Why don't you talk about non-grandfathered plans, and then I'll talk to Anthony a little bit about grandfathered plans. How's that?
I actually love grandfathered plans, especially when you're using the EASE system. A lot of our clients kept their grandfathered plans. And when you compare the benefits and the pricing to the ACA plan side by side, the grandfathered 90% of the time wins out. Way better benefits, way less out-of-pocket risk, and very affordable. That being said, one of the things, and it's a caveat to what you're asking, that I consider with employers every year, because every year the out-of-pocket maximums on these ACA plans increase and the benefits decrease. So most families, they're making what, $60,000 to $100,000 a year for a family of four, or an individual, say even in California where we have high earnings, your average earner is making $60,000 a year. Those employees can't afford an $8,000 after tax out of pocket bill. And God forbid they end up with a chronic illness that's going to span two calendar years and they're going to hit that out of pocket maximum twice, or even three times, or even every year if it's something like a leukemia and it's going to go on year after year. So one of the things I would consider even before looking at employer contribution is plan design. And I would sacrifice network access for the lower income employees and even some of the medium income employees for benefit. So I would rather have higher benefit, lower out-of-pocket maximum. Always watch that your plans for your people that can't afford heavy out-of-pocket costs, have co-pays rather than co-insurance percentages on high-cost items such as emergency room, complex imaging, that's usually a CT, an MRI or a PET scan, outpatient surgery, hospital, and specialty drugs such as cancer drugs or chronic illnesses like leukemia and Parkinson's. Those drugs are very expensive. If you have a percent on those, you can very, very readily run up an $8,000 bill. And for most families and even most individuals, even in California, where we are high income earners, they cannot afford those out-of-pocket costs. So you're much better off either having a low annual out-of-pocket or making sure that there are not co-insurances on high-cost services so that people aren't running up bills to $8,000 at the blink of an eye. Then, after that, we look at the contribution strategy. And most employers can either do that as a percent or a defined contribution. And again, I would say the fact that your employees, especially those that have families, are paying the majority of the premium. If you run in and you actually run a calculation on what the total premium is, what the employer paid portion might be, and what the employees paid last year, you can, as an employer, be surprised and realize that the majority of the premiums are running through a cafeteria plan on a pre-tax basis. And as such, you're not matching the back end FICA tax. You're 7.65%, which covers your Medicare and your old age Social Security and disability benefits. And you're also saving on some of the other taxes, such as your workers' comp, which is a percent of gross taxable payroll. So as an employer, you're saving 10% or more on every dollar that your employees are pre-taxing. So when you take a good look at the financials, you may then realize that contributing more to the plan is actually more affordable than you thought it was. So don't just go with, we're only going to fund a bronze plan, da da da. I would seriously try and make sure that your employees and their families are not exposed to high risk. And so try and get a decent insurance for them and pay a lot towards that. If at all possible, pay as much as you can. It's not going to cost you as much as you think it's going to.
Thank you, Anne. Anthony, what about what we do? Let's talk about whether plans, whether companies, clients are grandfathered or non-grandfathered. If they're grandfathered, they can only raise their contributions according to the actual rise in healthcare costs, correct? How can you help calculate those contribution amounts and those increases for employers?
Well, every year for our grandfather groups, which most of our self-funded plans are grandfathered, the non-grandfathered is kind of covered under what Anne was stating. Just make sure it's under the affordability or it meets affordability. The grandfather plans, every year, it's all based upon their last year's claims. So we took a snapshot. That's what Dorothy always says. We took a snapshot where your plan was in March of 2010. And where your benefits were, and also where your contributions were, and we go there. Now, the government originally gave us to stay grandfathered. The government gave us, we could increase the contributions 5% only. So, of course, my groups took that the first year. That way, they get their additional 5%. But that was the limit. If you went to 6%, then you were no longer grandfathered, and you were non-grandfathered. So every year, after we finalize the stop-loss rates with the reinsurance company, then I give each of my clients exactly where they are. Let's say for some reason their claims increased by 20% that year. They can bring, as long as it's under, you know, it's affordable by law, then they can move their contributions up 20%. The problem then, the next year, if their claims are down, then they have to lower them even below what they were the prior year. So every year they can go up or down. A couple of my clients just kept their contributions the same and just, am I okay under these contributions for this year? And I say, yes or no. And they said, let's just keep them the same, because it's a pain to go, you know, one year you go up 10%, then you go down 40%, then you go up 50%. And then it's, you know, to the employees, if the employees can hear, hey, it's the same as last year. I have a group that went like 10 straight years with the exact same contributions, and the employees loved it. You know, they could have gone up a little bit, but not that much, because they were actually a really, really well-run self-funded group on that. So every year I give that to them, and that's how they make their final decision.
And keep in mind, Anthony was talking primarily about with the claims activity going up and down. That's because, again, the majority of our clients are self-funded. We do have some fully insured cases as well, of course, but it works a little differently in the self-funded world. And Anne, that's why I wanted to have Anthony discuss this as well, because it works completely differently than in the fully insured market. Anthony, again, we have a lot of self-funded clients, as I just mentioned. So they're not packaged products. They are all custom plans. How important is communication with their TPA, their stop-loss carriers, et cetera, of everything that's going on, any changes that are made during open enrollment? How important is that, what we call our renewal checklist, that you get to the TPA with all of that renewal data and notification, you know, of the plan amendments, everything that's changing, you know, whatever we've done, what we've added, what we've deleted, whatever. How important is all that to get to all the right parties?
Well, it's, you have to do it. I mean, everybody has to know the changes. You know, the first thing we like to finalize is what plan changes, okay? Because those need to go into the open enrollment packets and the open enrollment meetings. We got to say, hey, this year your dental plan is doing this, or this year your medical plan, we're adding this benefit, let's say, for, you know, whatever type of a benefit. We can't take anything away, because if they're grandfathered, they can't, and nothing can be taken away. But then we finalize the stop loss rates. We can finalize those usually 45 days out. Once we get 10 months of claims information for the plan year, we can then finalize that. We always, when we go shopping, because every year we go shopping for, you know, just to see who is competitive and who's not. but we always like to give the current stop loss carrier last look to see if they can go down, because unlike fully insured, under 100 plans here in California, you can't negotiate rates. But when you're above 100, you can negotiate rates, and you can negotiate especially self-funded stuff. So we always say, hey, we got a little lower, some competition over here. Can you, take a little bit off your renewal? And then we go with that. Obviously, we will change stop loss carriers. It's always good to stay with the same stop loss carrier if you can, because most of them have gapless coverage, meaning incurred and paid. I don't know how much you want me to go into that, which I won't, but it's gapless coverages are good. But if you change carriers, that can be a problem if a claim comes in really late. Then what we do is you have to let the TPA know. And we created a nice 6-7 page renewal checklist for the TPA. We discuss obviously all the rate changes, any other changes that the group wants. We give them their new COBRA rates, because the TPAs generally do the COBRA for them. We give them the plan amendments at that time, and we just give them any new information that they might need. There's a lot of information. A lot of times it doesn't change, like group contacts usually don't change year to year. Sometimes they do, sometimes HR people change every year, but for the most part, the higher ups, the CFOs, the fiduciaries of the plan aren't changing. So, but that's how we like to get it out to everybody at least a month in advance. That way the TPA has time to put in their system. That way the billing goes out on time for the first month of the plan year.
Thank you, Anthony. So what I want to do now is summarize the most effective best practices overall for open enrollment. We've all kind of mentioned a lot of these, so I want to kind of start again from Maryland's perspective, from a legal perspective. Can you tell us what the best practices overall that you use for open enrollment?
Make certain you are distributing all the documents you are required to distribute and that you follow the ERISA distribution rules. You want to make certain that the distribution methods chosen, consistent with the rules, result in actual receipt by each eligible employee.
Thank you, Marilyn. Anne, what are your best practices for fully insured plans?
Similar to how you operate, we always shop the benefits. It's important. We have some clients don't want to change accounting companies, law firms. They're more reluctant to change even with savings. But it's a very good idea to sit down annually with an employer and review where they are, shop the market, so that they know why they're staying or why they're moving. And that's a conscientious decision. Secondly, you build obviously your renewal into ease. You do it in your handout packets, making sure that everything is included. If you're changing any benefits, that the new benefits are included. For those of you using EASE for the first time, the first year is always a double build. You're building in your current benefits, which are current elections, and then you're building in your open enrollment benefits and mapping the elections over. So you can actually roll over onto the new plans, and EASE will do that for you. The nice thing about that system on the medical, they have an Excel comparison chart. It'll show the current plan and benefits against all the future options for an employee. The system has links if the build is done properly and detail that link into provider networks. The system has an employee application that can go on their phone, and it can go on all the family members' phones, which gives them access to benefits year round, including the summary of benefits, provider networks, you name it. All the family members can have access. When we launch an open enrollment, the system will allow us broadcast email all of the employees and notify them of any changes to expected open enrollment, such as a carrier change, a contribution change, anything that is mandatory that they need to do. While the open enrollment is in process, you can run progress reports and email participants that have not finished making their elections every couple of days to remind them when open enrollment will be closing and that they need to go in and look at the system. Mandatory disclosures such as your summary plan docs, your SBCs, the marketplace notice can be built in as a mandatory read in the EASE system. It just means before an employee signs off, the system will not allow them electronically sign without opening those docs, and the system captures and forever holds the fact that they opened them and read them, which is to your benefit. So it's really great on compliance. We personally do one-on-one enrollments at open enrollment with the employees, because there's nothing like being able to sit down with an insurance agent and walk through your benefits and really educate yourself or discuss HIPAA issues, health issues, with your benefit counsellor at that point in time. That uses a lot of resources. And the good news is once your employees are using an online system year after year after year, that becomes less necessary. Most of our open enrollments, half the employees have logged in and done their benefits before we even go out to meet with them. And that would be my closing comments on that.
Thank you, Anne. Anthony, what about best practices for self-funded plans?
Oh, this one's really easy. The best practices is have on self-funded plans or large groups, have your open enrollment meetings mandatory. Okay, a lot of these groups out there, they don't make them mandatory. We actually offer spouses to show up to the open enrollment meetings because some of our groups, let's say we have a beer distributorship, and most of the people there are male. And so let's say a lot of the guys don't really handle the insurance, or if they have kids and all that stuff, the spouse does, and they never get to attend. That's one reason why we put videos of all of our open enrollment meetings online. That way they can access them in case they miss it. But to make them mandatory, that's very, very important. Have them sign in, because it's inevitable that sometime during the plan year, somebody will say, hey, I didn't realize this change. Well, you were at the open enrollment meeting? No. Well, that's kind of a you thing, not really an us thing on that. So just make sure, you know, we give them thick packets they can take home and all that stuff, but just have your employers make the meetings mandatory, because that makes a big difference for understanding the plans.
Anthony, was there anything else you wanted to add to that other than making the meetings mandatory?
Just have to have the information available, have during the open enrollment meetings, have the vendors out there. That's pretty much it. Just make it available to the employees. And one of the ways to do that is make it mandatory.
Okay. Marilyn, I think you might have some additional comments you'd like to make.
Well, I'm just going to emphasize what Anthony said. Having the open enrollment meetings mandatory is an excellent idea. I'll follow up on a comment I made earlier about making certain that you can track who was present and who wasn't, so that you can establish who was made an offer of coverage and who wasn't made an offer of coverage, or a better way to put that, so you can track that you made an offer of coverage to all eligible employees. This is absolutely critical for the ACA Forms 1094, 1095 reporting. I mentioned the importance of the documentation. Make sure it's up to date. If we talked about plan changes that can go into effect every year, if those plan changes means that you have to make changes to your SPD and your SBC, make sure that you've made those and you're distributing the most up-to-date documents. And have a good enrollment form or waiver form, one that has all of the elements that will be required if you're ever audited by the DOL and you can establish that the coverage that you offered to each employee was made, and that they were offered the lowest cost plan, that it establishes what the contribution schedule was for that lowest cost plan, and that they were given the opportunity to waive out and the reason for waiving out.
Thank you, Marilyn. Well, thanks, everyone, for being here today and having this great discussion on open enrollment. I really appreciate y'all being here today.
What a great session. It was so much fun chatting with all of you. Employers work hard to put together a great benefit package for their employees, and it is important to make certain through the open enrollment process that they're communicating what those benefit offerings are, and that employees are then given an opportunity to make the best choice for themselves and for their families.
And I'll pop in and with the fact that we are becoming more modernized. Compliance is getting more and more difficult. There is way more legislation. It's coming at us faster than ever. So it's important to stay up on what your legal requirements are. And as Anthony said, and Marilyn stressed, and I will stress even further, and it's not being done properly. I'm tired of looking at it. Document, document, and document again. You better have signed documents for stuff that is a mandatory compliance issue.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you for having me. This is my first podcast. My anxiety didn't go through the roof. I'm a little surprised by that. So if you need to contact me, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm at Advanced Benefit Consulting. So it's on the webpage you got this podcast from.
Thanks, Anthony. So if anybody wants to reach out to any of you, how would they do so? Marilyn?
Yes. If anyone has any follow-up questions for me, please reach out at Marilyn@MonahanLawOffice.com.
Great. Thank you. What about Anne? How can they reach you?
My email is anne@kellyandkellyinsurance.com, spelled out fully.
Thank you, Anne. Well, thanks to all of you. I really appreciate you being here with me today. For everybody else out there, thank you for listening and thank you for helping our Benefits Executive Roundtable be such a success. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754 extension 3, toll free at 866-658-3835, or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.